Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome to another episode of Turn the Page podcast, Syosset Public Library's podcast. I am one of your librarian hosts, Stacey Mencher, Reader Services Librarian, with my co-host,
Jessica, Community Engagement Specialist, and also a librarian.
And we are really excited to interview our guest author today. If you'd like to introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Rosemary Simpson, and I'm currently writing a mystery series set in the Gilded Age in New York City.
We are very excited. We got news from Larissa at Kensington about your fifth book in your series, Death, Diamonds, and Deception. And the title grabbed me at first because I was like, ooh, like... a whole bunch of stuff I like.
Stacey is very, very distracted by shiny things, and that's why we love her.
I am. Thank you. So I saw the title, and then because I was looking at like the different cozies that are coming out and whatnot, and then I was looking more into it. I'm like, ooh, it's a historical cozy set in the Gilded Age, which always attracts me because I mean I read historical romance in that period. Sometimes, and I'm very excited for the book, and now I need to like read the previous ones to learn all about the character. So if you want to give us a little brief summary about the series and the book, that'd be great.
I will be glad to, Stacey. Let me jump in and say, it's not really a cozy. None of my books are cozies. They are historical noir is what I'd have to call them.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah, because my villains are really, really bad. And you are invited to absolutely despise them and hate them. They really, really are bad. There's a lot of murder. There's a lot of blood, a lot of gore, a lot of horrible things happen. So I'm historical noir rather than cozy.
Ooh, which is interesting.
I like that though.
You came to us through Kensington. Yes. Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah. And actually what happens to me sometimes is that I often get onto panels with cozy authors or straight historicals. And I have to make that fine distinction, because I did have one fan who wrote me a very indignant letter a few years ago and said, I bought your book and it wasn't a cozy. And I had to think, okay, no, it wasn't. And if you read the jacket flap, you knew it probably wasn't going to be a cozy. But at any rate, so the series is set in New York. The first book starts in March of 1888. And I had the idea for the hero and the heroine. I knew what the mystery was going to be, but I needed a place to hide a body. And it just so happened that in March of 1888, New York City had the most horrendous snowstorm in the history of the city.
How convenient.
It was a wonderful snowstorm. I mean, for a murder, it was an absolutely wonderful snowstorm. Where else would you hide a body except in a snowdrift? It's perfect. And if you look at the New York Times and some of the magazines of the era, they have wonderful sketches of arms sticking up out of snowdrifts and of the railroads being completely submerged under these huge, huge mountains of snow. Parts of the Hudson River froze. People were skating across the Brooklyn Bridge, which had just recently opened. So it was a wonderful time. So I, as soon as I read about that snowstorm, I knew that that's where the exact year it was going to be set. Because when you're writing a historical fiction, the most important thing is getting the exact time frame. You've got to set it in the right era and then in the right year within that era, because the rest of the books in your series are going to depend on that. So that was how I chose the 1888 to start it off with. Now, this book is number 5, and it is set in December of 1889. So I do one book a year for Kensington. And okay. As you can see, I don't do it in real time. So book five is only a couple of years later, basically. And this one, all of my books are set against a social background. There's a social issue in there. It's not going to leap out and hit you over the head, but there is a social issue or a historical event there. And in 1887, the French government, the Third Republic, auctioned off the French crown jewels, the ones that were left after the revolution that could be found and that had been confiscated and so forth. Now, a lot of them disappeared, but there were still a lot of them left. And Tiffany bought 2/3 of the inventory and brought them back to the United States. Almost as soon as the auction catalogs were published, people began to create imitations of these gorgeous necklaces and tiaras and rings and earrings and things like that. And so I said to myself, that's fantastic. What if, because remember that Mrs. Carolyn Astor was famous for her diamonds, and all of the wonderful society matriarchs of the Gilded Age wore incredible jewels. What mm-hmm. if somebody created a gorgeous necklace, had Tiffany's create a gorgeous necklace for his wife, and what if some of the diamonds in the necklace were stolen? Not the whole necklace. Because that would arouse too much suspicion. But what if some of the diamonds were stolen out of the necklace one by one and my protagonist discovered it? I've got a mystery there right away. So I started, when I was doing the research, I found out also that it had become fairly common for many of the aristocratic families in England and some of the Gilded Age people too. As they came upon financial difficulties, they would have some of the genuine stones taken out of their gorgeous, gorgeous necklaces, for example, and replaced with paste so that they could sell them and nobody would know what they were doing, that they were losing money, that they were going bankrupt. Anyway, so that was the basis of the story. And then, of course, it got very, very complicated after that because you have murders and you have alcoholism and you've got all kinds of things that were going on at the time. Does that help, Stacey? Is that?
Yeah, no, it's. Because I read the brief thing about. That we got on, I have my prep sheet. it seems so interesting because you have your protagonist, the heiress Prudence McKenzie, and her partner, who's an ex-Pinkerton agent, Jeffrey Hunter. And it's, I like that it's a male-female kind of detective duo. And she's the high society part, and he not so much. And I like that you bring that together, and I'm because I'm always intrigued by like the social like hierarchy of like Gilded Age and Victorian era. So I'm used to like Victorian era and like a lot of like British stuff, so when it yes. comes to like, you know, our home soil, I'm like, ooh, like what about this? And then I go down that research rabbit hole, which leads me to one of my questions, like of all your different books, especially with this fifth one, do you like, how do you get pulled into what you know the story's going to be, and how much research do you put into it, or did you like know all of this ahead of time?
No, I do a lot of research, and I do a lot of research before I ever put pen to paper or fingers to computer keys. And one of the things that is marvelous is to read the New York Times archives, because I read the Times every day. I'm a former New Yorker myself, so you know, you never really leave New York. So even though I'm in Arizona now, I'm still basically mm-hmm. part of me is in New York. And I read the New York Times every day. And so since I subscribe to it online, I also subscribe to the archives. So in fact, the other day, or last week, I guess it was, I'm starting book 7 right now. And I was reading the New York Times for fall of 1890. And it all week long, that's all I did, 4 or 5, 6 hours a day. I kept reading the Times and reading the Times. So I'm reading everything that's going on in the city, the society column, the crimes that are being committed, the politics, the social news, all of that type of thing. And you fall into a wonderful pattern of being there. It's like reading your and if you allow yourself to do that, you're just engulfed by the time period. So that's one of my major research options. And then the other is the standard history books, lots and lots of biographies and lots of histories. And of course, internet. I mean, it's an absolute trove of information. Mm-hmm. So that's basically it.
Hey, because I read when I was reading up about you, I read that you had mentioned that like you want to be like accurate to the time period. You don't want to just kind of, you know, make up your own stuff about it. Because as a reader, I think that's really cool because I learned something new. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that.
If I do switch something out for the sake of the story, I acknowledge it at the end in the author's notes. And I did that with one book where I have the use of a telephone. Mm-hmm. A little bit early, I needed it a little bit early. And so I had to apologize to my readers and explain that I had used this particular telephone a little bit earlier than it would have been available.
I was just reading that Mark Twain was the person in the 19th century who called the Gilded Age the Gilded Age.
Yes.
And it's such a beautiful description as to why he called it that. It's what it means is that the period was glittering on the surface, but he felt that it was corrupt underneath.
Yes.
That
attracted me to it because there were so many similarities between that period and our own period. And you can find that in many of the historical periods that you're looking at, but especially in the Gilded Age, there was no income tax, for example. You had an enormous disparity in wealth between the very, very wealthy and the abysmally poor. New York City itself was a city of immigrants, a city of tenements. It was Jacob Riis and How the Other Half Lives, side by side with this enormous amount of wealth with the Vanderbilts and the Carnegies, and it just tremendous change. And also you had the advent of electricity, the advent of the telephone. There were no cars. And even in the snowstorm pictures and sketches of 1888, you see a forest of telephone poles and electricity poles. And they were all snapping under the force of the snow. But it's something that if you look up at the sky today, you're not seeing that. You're not seeing that absolute forest. So it was a time of tremendous manufacturing, of movement. Don't forget the Civil War had only ended in 1865. So you have a whole displaced population moving north and west. It's a wonderful, wonderful period. And you can explore it on many different levels. You can stick with the aristocracy, the American aristocracy. Mm-hmm. You can go into the slums. You can do both. You can do all kinds of wonderful things.
I think of the Carnegies, and you know, as a librarian, it's such like this weird balance. You know, you think of the Carnegies, but then you think of the Carnegie Libraries.
Yes.
Yes. I had the chance to visit the Sleepy Hollow Cemetery way back, and I believe there's some of the graves of the Carnegies there. And
oh, wow.
Man, the architecture. I mean, I'm hoping that I'm not misremembering this, but I believe that's where it was. And now I'm going to look it up and fact check myself. But the architecture of the tombs alone, it just kind of blew my mind. And there was, I remember the tour guide spoke about almost like, there was almost like a contest as to whose tomb would be more beautiful. I mean...
there aren't any mansions left on Fifth Avenue anymore, but they were they were palaces. Some of them very gaudy. they were bringing in all kinds of architectural things from Europe. So they were mixing Italian it with French, with Rococo, with all kinds of things. And there were palaces all up and down Fifth Avenue, which were marvelous. And the fourth book series is actually set on an island I created off the coast of Georgia that's based on Cumberland Island, where Carnegie built the Carnegie family built some of their mansions. So, you know, and I try to put into each book a few real people, but I can only put them in if it's historically correct.
That's really cool. So you got like a dose of actual like history in it in terms of the fictional plot.
I think, well, if you're writing historical fiction, you do have a choice. You can either write alternate historical fiction, or you can be stay true to the history. And the only place that I have any wiggle room is where you don't know what happened. But I can't do anything that is against the actual history of the time.
That makes sense. And you know, I think about it because steampunk is kind of a big thing that people are fans of with alternate history. And that's it's interesting kind of to see the gymnastics, the way that they take what was real and add this, like, almost like what sci-fi would have been in that time period. But you have to appreciate the accurate, you know, the stuff that's taken from actual, you know, because it was pretty interesting in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you made that early on when you're deciding how you're going to write or what you're going to write. And I've chosen the path of absolutely not deviating from what actually happened and only filling in blanks that are actually empty for me.
So just to kind of go back to what I had said before, because I had to just check myself, because as a librarian, if I spread misinformation, I go into the librarian corner with a hat of shame. Andrew Carnegie was buried in Sleepy Hollow. However, his tombstone was exceptionally modest compared to some of his peers. He had a very modest tombstone, and I'm actually looking at a picture of it now. But my point remains that people would have these elaborate tombs, and as to your point,
doesn't surprise me though, because of how they lived. Like when I first think Gilded Age, I think of Newport and like the giant houses they had there. And I remember visiting years ago and being like, what did people do with all these rooms and all this space and all of this? I was like, oh my God. And then to think of like the mansions you bring up on Fifth Avenue, like so crowded, and like, but all the room and the ballrooms and everything, I'm just like, oh my God, it's so out of my scope of knowing that, like, when I read about it and imagine it, I'm like, oh my gosh.
It was an age, an era of extravagant excess, really. It's almost vulgar. It was so extravagant. And when you contrast that with the abysmal poverty of the tenements, especially in the large cities, and the cholera and the dysentery that, and the deaths of young children, it can't help but astound you. And then you think about other places in the world that are not as prosperous as the United States, for example. And you see those disparities are still there.
And the fact that you bring the idea of jewels from the French Revolution into that has got to be obviously related, because you think about, you know, excess, like, you know, the disparity, and obviously things ended very differently then, but...
I think diamonds from that should have gone into a Marie Antoinette necklace are much more interesting than just plain old diamonds.
Sure, of course.
Yeah. I made up some of it, because I think that what I developed in it is that the necklace that is created by Tiffany is supposed to be a copy of one that Louis the 16th was going to have made for Marie Antoinette after she gave birth to the Dauphin. And I think in the book I say they never got around to actually making it, but the jeweler's drawing still existed, and that's why this wealthy New York banker had it made for his wife. I made that up, but you know, I didn't make up the fact that there were a lot of facsimiles and copies made of the French crown jewels.
That's really cool, because it fits that people would make the copies. It adds to. And having it be for Marie Antoinette, it adds like the history, which is, I know, really important when you have the, like, what makes it so spectacular of why people want it. Like, I just think of like the auctions at like Christie's that like pop up on newsletters that I see of like, oh, something like this went for, you know, like millions of dollars, and it's, you're buying it for the history. It's that it adds the value and everything. And it just, now I want to kind of like, imagine I'm gonna have to look up and see like the type of jewelry and everything, because it's fascinating what people can make, and especially when you have like a name that's so famous, like Tiffany's involved as well.
We have a similar situation when Princess Diana was given that gorgeous sapphire ring, engagement ring. The copies were made, they were everywhere. And a lot of them were phony stones, they were paste. But, you know, I can remember lots of people buying them and having them at, they were at Macy's, for heaven's sakes, or copies of them.
Now, when you write your stories of the duo, do you have more fun writing Prudence, or do you have more fun writing Jeffrey?
Ooh, that's a question. That question has never, I've never asked, been asked that question before. All right, let me think about that. Actually, I enjoy both of them. And I deliberately made Jeffrey an ex-Pinkerton and a Southerner because I wanted to have a clash of cultures. It wasn't enough just to have the tension, the male-female tension. I wanted a clash of cultures. I wanted a clash of education, for example. And I enjoy writing both of them because they are very different. And it allows me as a writer to step into different personalities and to approach a story from different perspectives. And hopefully I'll get some of that across to the reader. I like Jeffrey too. I really do like Jeffrey. And he's getting a little bit more, there, different books have different emphasis. And let me see, Jeffrey was, oh, it's a spoiler, I can't tell you. Never mind. Never mind.
So listeners, you just have to read through the books to see the evolving characters and relationships.
Gosh. Right, and in fact, I think one of my readers sent a question: are Prudence and Jeffrey ever going to get together? Okay, so this book five is coming out next month. Book six, I just sent to my editor in New York a couple of weeks ago, and I just started book seven. I'm getting there, but it's very slow. I'm dragging it on, so it's almost excruciatingly slow.
I feel like when we interviewed Deanna Rayborn, she also said something similar, that she was kind of dangling it and drawing it out with Veronica Speedwell and Stoker. Nice. Yeah, but I don't think people are stopping the books because of that. They're just like, come on.
Enjoy a good slow burn.
Questions as to what you need to do.
Yes.
Now, you say that you're working on seven. Do you have an idea of how many you'd want in the series, or you're just playing it by ear?
I'm contracted through seven, and we'll just see what happens after that. It depends on readership and sales, of course.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's exciting, though, that you're up to seven. Oh, wow. Because, yeah, you said five comes out next month. We have the date that it's November 24th. Now, as we're recording this interview, it's still pandemic life with COVID-19. Did that affect anything of when your book was being released, or it's on the schedule that it was?
It's still on the same schedule. Yeah, I have a book. My books come out at the end of November every year. And so I wasn't changed this year. I know a lot of people were changed. Mm-hmm. I've spoken to a lot of the fellow authors, and they were just postponed for a while, and it's a difficult time in the writing community right now. And I'm sure that if you've interviewed people recently, we all seem to be saying the same thing, which is that you would think that with all this extra time and being confined and not going out and so forth, you'd be writing your brains out and so forth. And a lot of us are having a very hard time concentrating and really working hard on something when we're so distracted by the awful news every single day, and we're concerned about family and friends, and it's a dark cloud hanging over your head, and you keep waiting for it to go away, but it's not.
That's true.
I think it's very interesting what people read during this time as well. You know, you have like the people who just need complete escape. Mm-hmm. Or you have the people who sort of need to throw themselves into something also frightening, but not this. Like, I can't imagine reading a pandemic book right now. I know we interviewed Chris Bojalian, and his book, The Red Lotus, is a pandemic book, which, you know, I mean, Mm-hmm. I'm sure some people do want to read about pandemic.
It, it came out right at the beginning too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's, it is very interesting, you know, because you do have people who, you know, mysteries distract you. They keep your mind exercised and working on something else.
And the one thing you do know for sure about a mystery is that the author promises you that it's going to be solved at the end and the bad guys are going to be punished. It's all going to be all right.
That's why I like books like that. I've been saying this, I don't know how many episodes you'd heard previously, but I'm always saying that I will read these books, and even though they have really dark premises or, you know, terrible things happen, there is a conclusion.
Right. Mm-hmm. And usually I try to sprinkle some humor in the book also as I write. I also try to develop the minor characters so that they're interesting. And a lot of them are based on real characters or real incidents that I've read about, especially as I'm reading the newspapers of the era. So some of these, the weirdest ones are probably drawn from real life. And I have some animals who are kind of fun in there every now and then. Mr. Washington, the white horse, is a favorite with people. So it may be noir, historical noir, but it has to have moments of lightness. Otherwise, you're going to be really gloomy. You don't want to do that.
I think it's great, though, because it has wide appeal, because we're talking about how, like, during the pandemic, some people want an escape. You could escape to the Gilded Age and the time period. Some people want to read a mystery. And you mentioned before, you said it yourself, that, you know, you've got some characters that, like, bad villains, like, it's just everyone loves someone to hate.
Yes.
So yes. It's got everything.
Do you enjoy writing a really bad villain?
I do. I really do. And the fact that sometimes I have to tone it down a little bit because I might get over the top. But I really do enjoy writing really bad villains. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I agree that a bad villain, and especially one who you know is eventually going to get their comeuppance, is so much fun to read, because when that comeuppance comes, you're like, and I just made like a victory this pump.
Like, yes,
this is audio.
I don't have to feel sorry for the villain. I don't have to, if he's killed somebody or done some other dastardly deed or a series of dastardly deeds, I don't have to be sympathetic towards him and think, oh, you poor thing, maybe you had an unhappy childhood or something like that. No, I can just absolutely see him for what he is. He's a nasty villain and I'm going to do something about it.
I think that's an interesting point, though, because I think that a lot of authors, and this isn't throwing any shade at them, everybody has their process, but there is sort of an inclination to creating villains that have a dark history that makes you feel bad for them at the end, and it doesn't always have to be that way.
No, and I think because I'm not writing psychological thrillers, so it's plus by having it in the Gilded Age in the late 1880s, I'm a little bit free of having to pay notice to the developments in psychology and psychiatry. So I don't really have to do that.
Yeah, you don't have to kind of diagnose somebody with narcissism or a personality disorder.
No, not a bit. Not a bit.
So you write the historical noirs. Is that what you read, or do you read across all genres?
I read everything. I just read. I think most writers are compulsive. We have to be compulsive readers. And I know my family always joked about the fact that whenever we packed to go on a trip, it was the books. It was the books that I was looking for more than clothes or anything like that. And I'll tell you a story about when I was growing up. We subscribed to Time magazine. And we all knew the day that the Time magazine would arrive. And it was who could get to the Time magazine first and go and lock yourself in the bathroom to read the Time magazine so you didn't have to share it with everybody else in the family for a while. It was the kind of compulsive reading. We were always reading. The joke also was that, you know, if you ran out of books to read, you could always go in the bathroom and read the directions on the aspirin bottle. But you would have something to read. You took a book with you when you went to anywhere. to stand in line or in a waiting room or anything like that. Yeah, I read. So I read everything. Sometimes some people will say that when they're in the process of writing, they try not to read in their genre because you don't want to inadvertently pick up something from another author that you didn't really mean to. You're not really realizing you're doing it. That's not a problem. The only thing I have to watch out for is names, because when you are writing, if you come, for example, the other day, I was writing a character and I loved the name, and it wasn't until a day or two later that I realized I had picked up on the name of somebody I know. It's a little bit unusual name and it was perfect for this character, but I better go back and change it because, you know, it's too unusual a name not to be associated with the person that I know. So there's always that type of thing. You're not quite aware that you're doing it. So I do, I read across all genres though. I read nonfiction and fiction, and I read the cozies and just about anything I can get my hands on, basically.
This has been awesome. Thank you so much for talking to us, Rosemary. We are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page on this episode. I have been one of your librarian hosts, Stacey, and I'm joined by
Jessica.
And we want to thank you so much to our guest author. Thank you so much, Rosemary. It has been a pleasure talking with you.
You're quite welcome. I thoroughly enjoyed every minute of it.
Well, time flies when you're having fun.
Yes, it really does.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.